what we've been celebrating as green growth is not green. It is just slightly greener than it used to be. GDP is a poor measure of quality of life, as simple as that. It's a quantitative indicator. GDP measures basically monetary agitation. Today, we leave capitalism because of its expensive nature, so economic growth, has a tendency to commodify certain things. You need money to do everything. Some missions are going to be non-lucrative, and there's going to be today a lot of shutdown missions, and we need the most creative minds to focus on these problems. We need as much innovation as we can to find ways for... Today we have a choice to make. Either we continue making profits for shareholders and we fry the only planet we have, irreversibly, and that has already started, or we accept and acknowledge the fact that...
Bonjour, bonjour, and welcome to Mission First, the podcast to learn from successful entrepreneurs changing the world for the better. In this podcast, you will learn from entrepreneurs who have already found product market fit and are scaling up fast. We discuss their challenges and the strategies they have applied to make things work. Think of it as a masterclass about business and product innovation, growth marketing, and leadership. I am Gilles Toussaint. I help mission-driven companies exceed their revenue objectives with growth marketing, product-led growth, and LinkedIn personal branding strategies. Today, I'm very excited to welcome Timothée Parikh. He's a PhD in economics, specialized in degrowth, post-growth. He's making big waves with his presentations. Just this year, he has done a TEDx presentation, a keynote speech at the event Beyond Growth, hosted at the European Parliament, a presentation called How to Blow Up an Economy at the University of Lund. He's inspiring dozens of thousands of people with his new book, Ralentir ou Périr, Slow Down or Perish or Die. It's one of the most fascinating books I read the past years. It completely changed my view about the world and what needs to be done in the future. Today, you are going to learn about degrowth, post-growth, and we are going to discuss what this means for entrepreneurs like you and me who want to have a bigger impact on this world with innovative products or services, and that usually means aiming at growth to have a bigger impact. Does it conflict with our goals? How can we adapt our strategy or our business models? Timothée, welcome to Mission First. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I'm excited.
I'm super excited too. So usually, you know, I interview founders from startups who have a positive impact on this world, you know, sustainable social mission. But you have a bit of a different background. So can you describe a bit to our audience who you are and what you do, maybe by starting with your mission on this planet?
Sure. So I'm a scientist. I guess that makes me some kind of knowledge entrepreneur. What we do as scholars is to try to discover new things. For me, I'm an ecological economist. That's my specialty. So I was an economist first, then I specialized in ecological economists. So the kind of my specialty is to try to better understand how the economy interacts with nature. During my PhD thesis, when I specialized into something even more specific within ecological economics, I decided to try to better understand degrowth as a scenario of rapid reduction of ecological footprint. So I've explored that concept, and now as a postdoc researcher, I keep digging, exploring more specific questions having to do with degrowth, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. But that's really how we work as scientists. You know, first you discover perhaps like ecological limits to growth. They were discovered in the 1970s. They've been further developed ever since. Then some other people specialize in like, okay, well, if there are ecological limits to growth, maybe we need to degrow. You specialize in what that means. And now for me, with a community of scholars, where, okay, if we have to degrow, how do we adapt some of our institutions? For example, the public finances, you know, how do you pay for public services, pensions, healthcare, all that, which is a very important question. If you're planning to contract your economy, you might want to have this sorted out. So that's what I'm doing at my postdoc at Lund University. And I've always been a scientist in the sense where I've been at university for 15 years. So I've never worked for a company, which some people listening to us maybe will find it weird. Like, who's that guy, you know, has they ever left a university classroom? The answer to that is no, I never have. And actually this is a weakness for many things. If you ask me to start a company now, I don't think it'll be a very successful venture. But that is also a strength, because in remaining within a university at context for all that time, I could just focus in developed alternative economic theories. Very, very alternative to the kind of economic system we have now. And I think these should be considered valuable today as we realize the shortfalls of today's system. We want a diversity of alternatives. And so people like me, and we're a diversity of young scholars working on that, we've been just focusing in digging out alternatives that maybe one day will inspire entrepreneurs in reality. I mean, maybe one day that I've already started, I think, as you said, kindly to inspire people in reality. So that's my position as a scientist, to work in exploring alternative futures that I hope stimulate creativity in the real world for today's decision makers.
I love this, the word you use, knowledge entrepreneur. And I'm pretty sure if you was at a company, you would be pretty successful, because you already got a lot of stuff right when I see you promoting your theories. Before we start talking about the problem with growth, is there something I need to understand in your background from your experience, your childhood, what pushed you to actually choose ecological economy, which is a term I didn't know there was such already parts of economy?
Well, it was a progressive move, studying economics, being interested in environmental issues. Of course, you're trying to apply the skills you have in solving the problem. So for me, as an economist, I was trying to apply what I'd been taught at university to solve, for example, climate change. And I realized the tools I had were insufficient. Because when you're being taught like basic neoclassical economics at university, you have a couple of power in your bag, like you know how to design a carbon tax, but that's pretty much it. I was like, wow, I need much more skills. And that's why I decided to move to Sweden to do one of the very few, you know, masters they had in ecological economics, because I wanted more tool. And then you have a bit of this matrix moment. Do you remember like Morpheus's, you know, giving the red pill, blue pill to Neo? And that was my moment. Or like when you study ecological economics, you take the red pill, which means that it gives you a vision. You see something you didn't see before. And that thing you see is flows of energy and matter. Once I had learned ecological economics, now I'm looking at anything, a company, a household, a market, a financial market, international trade. And I don't only see the euros you would see as an economist. I also see flows of energy and matter. I see these human activities are always embedded within ecosystems. Unfortunately or fortunately, that's an irreversible move. Once you see them, you cannot unsee them. And so for me, when I discovered, you could say, the ecological consequences of our economic mode of organization, I realized, damn, something is going to go horribly wrong at some point. You know, it's like you're a doctor and you see your friend every year is gaining 10 kilos. And you're like, you know, basics, anatomy, you know how the body works. And you see your friend getting like more and more obese every year. And you worry for their health. You're like, damn, like at some point, something's going to give, you know, and that guy's going to die. Well, that's what I've been feeling about the economy for the last 10 years. I'm like, at some point, something is going to collapse, and that's going to be horrendous. So that's why I completely refocused my work in trying to find ways of avoiding that moment where the economy dies.
That's exactly what I could describe, what your book changed for me in terms of the view I have about the world. Because as you said, once it clicked, then you start seeing things very, very differently. So let's dive into that. What is the current problem with the growth?
Very simply, when an economy grows, it uses more energy and materials. It has been so over time. And so when an economy gets very big, well, then usually the ecological footprint of that economy gets very big too. The problem is that we have, you know, what we call planetary boundaries, because we have finite ecosystems, and these ecosystems have finite carrying capacities. The climate, for example, we know the atmosphere can only absorb a certain quantity of greenhouse gases. If you over-emit, if you go over that threshold, then you risk shifting the climate system. You're warming up the climate, and then you have the bad consequences that come with it. So our problem right now is what we call ecological overshoot. We are overshooting planetary boundaries. We are in the red zone. You know, imagine you're just going to an elevator and you can only, I don't know, be like 800 kilos in the elevator. And now we are in this elevator, but not with 800 kilos. We're like 1.6 tons. And we can hear the little, you know, metal cord holding the elevator, like breaking once, you know, like one ping. Like an action film. And we know at some point that's going to break. So our problem right now is ecological overshoot. And when you further grow, because growth is an exponential pattern. So when we say an economy, you know, has a 3% growth, it's 3% growth of the actual size of the economy. So the bigger the economy is, the bigger it gets when it grows. And if you're already in overshoot, that makes lowering your ecological footprint much more difficult. In the analogy of a diet, it's like you want to lose weight, but you want to continue eating more. So, of course, you can stop eating like fast food and eat a lot of veggies and stuff. But at some point, it will be easier to lose weight if you also limit the intake of food you have. So for me today, degrowth is focusing on these overly obese, overshooting countries, which are all high-income countries, so it's a very specific strategy for rich countries, to try to put them on a diet.
What is the issue with GDP? This was something very insightful from your book that I'd love everybody to hear. What's the hidden consequences behind the way we calculate GDP?
GDP is a poor measure of quality of life, as simple as that. I mean, it's a quantitative indicator. GDP measures basically monetary agitation. So every time you have euros moving around in your economy, GDP goes up. But it doesn't tell you whether these activities contribute to well-being. It doesn't tell you whose needs are being satisfied. If it's just like agitation within spheres of people that already have enough luxury goods and stuff like this, or it doesn't tell you if it's targeted growth for those households that are actually living in poverty. So GDP is a bit of a, you know, measuring activity in a quantitative way at the level of an entire economy. So it's pretty broad. What I think we should do is just accept the fact that GDP is a very specific indicator of monetary agitation, which can be used to measure certain things, but should not be taken as a compass for development. We should base development and the entire process of civilization and, you know, political governance, all of that on several indicators of quality of life. Well-being, equality, happiness, autonomy at work, you know, all these kind of quality of housing, quality of mobility, all of these things that really determine quality of life, like life expectancy, access to education. That's what we should be focusing on. I find that today we give much too much importance to GDP. I mean, when you hear people like announcing their political program and countries, right? It's always about GDP. Even when we understand that we need to do something about the climate and ecology in general, then people will be like, ah, yeah, I know we're just slowly cooking ourselves to death, but if we emit less emissions, that risk lowering GDP. And I'm like, I mean, who gives a shit? Like, yeah, that will lower this imaginary indicator we created in the 1930s. And so in the Excel sheet of a few national statisticians, yeah, GDP will go down. But on the other hand, you know, the climate will stabilize and all the well-being risk associated to climate collapse will just disappear. And that's true development. That's true improvement. So today, I think it's a matter of just re-putting priority first, like social well-being, ecological sustainability, those are like two primal goals for an economy. All the rest, GDP, inflation, all of that stuff, they're just means of reaching that. And we should not, you know, look at the finger when you're pointing to the moon. The moon is social well-being and ecological sustainability. The means is to make sure your economy is working well. But the goal is not just to, today we feel like obsessed with making the economy work well. It's like, you know, you bought a very expensive car, because you wanted to go somewhere. But then you get too carried away about how cool that car is. And so you're focusing on the engine and you forget that you were actually driving somewhere. You're just looking at like how the engine runs. And now you're dedicating your life to making that engine run as perfectly as possible. But you're not going in the right direction. And actually, you're late for your meeting. So the purpose of getting the car in the first place has been forgotten. And now we're just completely obsessed about just how smoothly the engine run, which is cool for economist nerds, but should definitely not be part of the collective imaginary.
Hey, just a 10-second break to tell you. I just released a free video presentation to explain the three key strategies I use to get 7,500 change makers to follow me on LinkedIn and to reach more than 1 million people this year with my posts. It's free. Just follow the link in the description to download it.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about how we have to turn around, actually, as you said, to go back in the right direction. I really love like the part about the GDP in your book when you explained like buying a drill has a positive impact on the GDP and the economy as, you know, Macron and a lot of politicians would define it as positive, but it has a negative impact if you actually share a drill with someone. What are some factors that are not taken into account in it? Because that was eye-opening reading for me in your book.
So GDP counts everything that has a price, and it counts it in proportion to the price it has. This is why for a very long time, neoclassical economists have defended that natural resources are completely unimportant to the economy because they represent such a small portion of national income, which is true. If you look at, for example, the national expense on fossil fuel, you know, it's very tiny. If you look at, let's say, the percentage of GDP of the agricultural sector, you see that it's so tiny. But on the other hand, it seems a bit strange to argue that growing food is relatively unimportant, because if we stop doing that, well, you know, we won't run financial markets or marketing firms, or we won't build cars or anything else, because we will all die of starvation. So somehow GDP is reflecting importance based on prices. Prices are being determined on markets. And some historically, we have gotten used to take natural resources for free and seeing nature as a whole as this kind of all-you-can-eat buffet and like, oh, oil, cool, I'll take it and sell it to whatever price is formed on the market, completely regardless of how important that resource is in the broader economy of nature. Same thing, let's say, for what we call ecosystem services. So let's say I buy a forest. I buy a chunk of the Amazon forest, let's say I buy all of it. And I'm like, cool, I would love to just turn that into a golf. And so I'm like, I will turn that into a golf and that's my private property. But what I don't take into account is all the ecosystem services that the Amazon forest was providing, including sequestration and absorption of greenhouse gases. So the kind of lungs of the planet, you know, as we say. Also, the fact that it hosts a diversity of species with this kind of biodiversity wealth. Also, the fact that it filtrates water and do all kind of thing, retain fertile soil. So I'm going to destroy all of that and I'm going to turn it into a golf. And maybe I will just, you know, open it to access to a few rich people. And in terms of GDP, I have created value because the Amazon forest serves no, I mean, it sells nothing. So therefore, it has no value compared to my golf course, which I can tell you is lucrative. And so in GDP terms, when you look at the process of destroying the and turning the entire Amazon forest into a golf course for rich people, that rings value creation. That rings progress. That rings, you know, a performant economy, which is a bit nonsensical, because if we were to turn every single forest into golf course, I think we'll soon realize that there's going to be a problem. And so GDP is very bad at including the ecological, and it's even worse at including the social that is non-monetary. I'll give you one example that for me was kind of shocking, because as many people in France, we grew up as kids and, you know, in Wednesday afternoon on Saturday, we would go to the local soccer club or playing badminton or whatnot. You know, we learned sport. And I've realized that all of these clubs, amateur clubs, they all run by volunteers. So you realize volunteer work is not included in GDP. It's considered worthless. So if you wanted, let's say, to boost GDP growth in France, you would say all of these amateur clubs, you'd be like, guys, stop running this club to teach soccer to kids and go work at McDonald's. You'll create more added value. But then all of a sudden, the ability, the service of for kids to be able to go and, you know, learn sports, meet other people would disappear. Imagine the social wealth that will be destroyed if we were to do this. Imagine also the kind of productivity-related skills. So all the team-building experience we had at kids, you know, learning how to play sports together. Now you come to a company and you have people that have never done something together. So like we're all completely like, we don't know how to communicate. We don't know how to listen to others. So we're also losing a tremendous amount of usable skills. So in the same way that in my example, we destroy the Amazon rainforest, it looks like good GDP, but it destroys a lot of wealth. Here, if we destroy all of the, you know, sports club, we somehow will gain in GDP because all of the coaches of these sports clubs that go and work for Starbucks and McDonald's now, they will just earn a wage and GDP will go up because they will sell Big Macs and Macchiatos. But somehow in the process, we would have gotten collectively poorer.
That's the social limits of growth in that case. What about the political limits of growth? When you hear false promises from lots of politicians in a hearing, like starting from Macron in France, and I mean lots of them who says that, you know, growth is actually good for inequalities. Capitalism and growth has been like has helped to improve a lot of things to a certain degree. When people say we need growth in order to overcome these inequalities, is it really true?
It's not factually true. So economists that focus on inequality, the work of Thomas Piketty comes to mind, for example, and there are many others, Jason Hickel, that has worked a lot on global inequality, and that has been looking at in his book, The Divide, of actually the historical record of global capitalism in eradicating poverty, which has done so, but not in as effective as it could have been. We realized that growth is not something that will reduce inequality or eradicate poverty because growth is a macroeconomic phenomenon. And when we look at rates of growth, so if you take France, let's say, and from one year to another, your economy is bigger. But then you need to ask yourself, where is the additional money going? If all the additional money you've created ends up in the pocket of, let's say, the lowest 30%, then that's good. That growth has eradicated poverty and it's fantastic. Historically, that's not what capitalism is best at doing for a very good reason that Thomas Piketty explained. You know, that's the R and G equation, where he's explaining when R, which is the rate of return on capital. So basically, you're rich, you have savings, maybe you've bought a few apartments in Paris, maybe you've bought yourself a few, you know, shares of lucrative companies. That the speed at which you will get richer as an individual is always faster than the general speed of the average person without saving getting richer. For example, someone that doesn't have a few property but is just seeing its wage as most of its income. So over time, capitalism concentrates wealth in the hands of people that have accumulated wealth and that can just make more money out of this accumulated wealth. And the only thing, according to Piketty's historical account, that can revert that is war, when a lot of accumulated wealth get destroyed, and state intervention, so various policies that redistribute wealth at many different levels where it's being created. So I think this narrative of just, we need to grow the pie so that everyone part gets bigger, it's nonsensical. Because people like Jason Hickel and others have done calculation of like, okay, fair enough. How much do we need to grow the global pie to eradicate poverty? And when you do this, you realize like we at current speeds, we would need to grow it like hundredfolds just, you know, to get some people out of extreme poverty. Whereas like in theory, you could very much phase out, eradicate poverty completely in France without any economic growth, just through redistribution. So here we also need to address these narratives. And I don't mean here to say that this is easy. We're all going to agree and there's going to be massive redistribution. Of course, there's a lot of political complexity in getting people to agree to that process. But at least we need to be very clear that in theory, there is nothing preventing poverty from being eradicated in all high-income countries without economic growth or even in contracting economies. So you can have a national income that is getting smaller with, let's say, the income of the poorer 50, 40, 30% getting higher. Hold on. Like mathematically, there's just nothing preventing this from happening. So for me, I get a bit upset when politicians say like this is not true. You know, this cannot happen. And so therefore we need to work more. No, in theory, it could happen. We could do it. Politically, we don't seem to believe in it and make it happening. But in theory, there's nothing preventing it.
I mean, this is why the richer are getting richer. So you explain it very well here. Before we start talking about degrowth, I had a debate with a VC on LinkedIn who was telling me that there is a decoupling, there is a green growth, there is a decoupling between growth and, you know, environmental impact. And he was sharing with me lots of resources saying, listen to it, like, you know, like there's a decoupling. And I've seen in your other conferences and in speech how like you gave all the facts. So can you like explain me your the facts here and like what the audience should hear about green growth?
Yeah, I find it strange that a lot of people defend this, but I get to debate with a few of them. And each time I prepare myself for the debate, like, you know, I'm a very young economist. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to debate these very experienced people and they're going to smash me to pieces. So I come with my best data, you know, best theory. I come with shiny slides, like overly prepared. And every time I realize that they have no proof. So here there is a scientific consensus building on the absence of green growth. I've been starting to keep track of that scientific consensus since the summer of 2019, where colleagues and I published Decoupling Debunked, which was a very arrogant report that I published based on a chapter of my thesis, because I was just announcing like, look, guys, we've been looking everywhere for your green growth. We've not found it. We've not found it. And we don't think it's actually possible for these seven reasons. If you think we're wrong, and maybe we are, just tell us, you know, just show proof that we're wrong and then we'll admit publicly that green growth is a thing. It's been 2019 and, you know, that report has gotten enormously popular, cited in the IPCC report and all, and I have not seen a single rebuttal of that report written by a PhD student. So I'm like, if a PhD student can debunk your theory must be pretty crap, you know? So people play with, I think, words without really clarifying what green growth is. So here's the way I explain it. Decoupling is, you know, the dissociation between rates of GDP growth and certain measures of environmental pressures. For example, emissions of greenhouse gases. So a country that is decoupling, and we call that absolute decoupling, would be a country that is increasing in GDP and decreasing emissions. Out of all countries in the world, there are 11 that have done so. So here I'm citing the latest study from Vogel and Hickel, 2023, Is Green Growth Happening?, that was published in The Lancet 2 days ago. And so what they find is out of these 11 countries, which have been absolutely decoupling, what matters then is to look at the speed of that decoupling. Because again, this is like for a diet. If you're like, dude, I've lost 100 grams in 20 years. I'm like, that's not a diet. Like, stop it. So same thing. If a country reduces emissions like very marginally, I mean, you cannot really call this decarbonization or, you know, fossil-free growth or green growth. So when Jason Hickel and Yefim Vogel in the article calculate how long it would take these high-income countries that have absolutely decoupled to reach carbon neutrality, they realize that it would take at current speeds, and that's the speed they achieved during between 2013 and 2022, it would take them 220 years. And in the course of that 220 years, they would overshoot their national carbon budget by 27 times. So now you realize there's a bit of a speed problem. It's like me being like, cool, I've got my diet sorted out. I want to lose 20 kilos and I started today and I will finish in 182. And like people, like any right-minded person would be like, Tim, you're full of shit. Like, come on, you'll be dead by now. So what we've been celebrating as green growth is not green. It is just slightly greener than it used to be, but it's still enormously unsustainable. And here, this study is only looking at greenhouse gases. What we should generally consider green growth is growth, so producing and consuming more, that is not using more water, more soil, more biomass, more metals, more minerals, that is not creating more local air pollution, global greenhouse gases emissions, production of waste, of e-waste, biodiversity loss. That's the kind of growth we could call green. If you take all these factors into account, the picture gets worse because actually the greenhouse gases is the things we've been best at reducing. So imagine when you look at material footprint in Europe, for example, between 1995 and 2019, it has increased by 9.4%. So you're like, that's not decoupling, that's recoupling. So it's getting more and more difficult, actually. I mean, you can imagine it's easy first to get your metals and minerals because they're just easy access. Now to find new ones, we need to dig deeper, and digging deeper requires more energy and therefore more materials and therefore more impact on biodiversity, water pollution, and all of that. So scientifically today, there are no people that really like defend like, yeah, we can green growth. It's a narrative that only exists within governments and companies. So it has become a form of greenwashing for governments and companies that are like, don't worry, we're going to green growth. Factually, there's no proof of that. So it's bullshit. And then there's also this kind of wishful thinking of people that, yeah, okay, no, but at some point in the future, technological progress will allow us to do so. Again, like that, what we do in scenarios and Jason Hickel and same thing in a study we'll publish with Jérôme Cuny for Europe, we're projecting to 2030, you know, and then you see that like, if you need to do things like 10 times faster, that the fastest speed of decarbonization we have ever had starting today and every single year, like that's completely unrealistic. It would be like saying, you know what, we're assuming that somehow starting tomorrow, every single human will run 8 times as fast as Usain Bolt. You know, like anyone would tell you like, yeah, okay. I mean, it's not theoretically impossible, but it's a bit far-fetched. Well, same thing, assuming that countries starting tomorrow will all accelerate their rates of decarbonization 10 times over and maintain this speed of decarbonization until 2030 or even further until carbon neutrality is not even wishful thinking. This is science fiction.
Everything I hear now, it's very, very clear all the issues we have with growth. How does it look like on a political, social, economic, or environmental level for you?
To start, I mean, the way I define degrowth, it all starts with the downscaling of production and consumption. So it will start by, let's say, a country announcing, acknowledging like, okay, guys, we've tried to green, not only growth, but we've tried to render our economy more sustainable. But we realize that at our current scale, we don't manage to reduce ecological footprint. And therefore, we're going to try to reduce certain forms of production and consumption to accelerate the lowering of the ecological footprint. This is basically, you know, your brain announcing you that you're going to stop eating like fast food and candies and soft drinks in order to lose like weight. That does not mean you're going to stop eating everything and forever. It means, well, there's going to be for a certain period of time, a contraction of certain sectors. And that contraction is going to be so big because we have 50 years of accumulated overshoot that for certain years, there's going to be more contraction than there is growth in sectors. And so at the macroeconomic level, your economy might get smaller. Again, statisticians looking at their Excel sheet might just get a bit of a panic attack seeing GDP like going down, but that should not worry us because we do this for the sake of getting back to a healthy, sustainable economy. So again, dual goal, social well-being, ecological sustainability. GDP is just a little indicator we should ignore for the moment. And that's the general narrative. Then of course, it comes with a number of policies because unfortunately there's not a single button at the minister, at the Ministry of Economy where you can, you know, shift GDP down like a little bit. No, you need to enact specific policies that will avoid certain activities. I mean, let's say you want to use less cars. So very diverse urban policies to render like to build car-free cities. You want to have like certain taxes on very heavy and polluting cars to phase them out. You want to incentivize car sharing schemes. You want to invest massively into public transport. You want to reduce, you know, speed limits on highways. You know, all these kind of, you want to make parking more difficult in certain places. You want to have subsidies for people to buy electric bikes. All of these things together should lead to the number of cars in France being used going down. That will be a degrowth policy that is itself made of like 100 different policies. It's not means that these policies are just extra, like we're just all of a sudden doing something very complicated. We're doing them already, except we're doing them in the wrong direction, because all these little policies we have, very often they are incentives to get more cars. So we're going to subsidize fuel to make it cheap. We're going to subsidize automobile industries, you know, so that they can expand. We're going to finance them. We're going to somehow subsidize highway companies so they can build more highways. We're going to do massive advertisements so people, you know, create a culture where they want to drive cars. So we're doing that already. It's just a matter of keep doing it, but with the opposite goal of actually trying to emancipate from car-based mobility, which does not mean, you know, staying on your couch and doing nothing. It means looking at other modes of mobility and considering avoiding certain kilometers of transport. I give you the best example as a scholar. You know, I think the last generation scholars, even social scientists, you know, would fly left, right, and center to go to random conferences. I mean, my generation is not doing this anymore. Look at what we're doing now. We're doing this online. I mean, I could have just flown to wherever you are and record this in your living room, and I'm sure it would have been lovely. But we're not doing this because we are aware that these kilometers can be easily removed. You know, that's the kind of avoid strategy from the IPCC. So we avoid a travel, which is the most sustainable way of lowering its impact. You know, even more sustainable than an electric car or bus or whatever, or a shared car, is just not having to move yourself. Same thing for food, when we're thinking like, oh, wow, if we can avoid consuming red meat, which is lower footprint, we increase levels of well-being. And that is just the very easy, low-hanging fruit. Same thing, to do that, you need a diversity of policy to take into account. So the way I see it is just degrowth is more of the objective, like the diet. And then all the things you have to do is to activate a lot of different switches. Some incentivizing more of certain things. We've seen, for example, e-bikes being available to people, and certain things disincentivizing other things like buying massive SUVs.
Hey, before you jump to the next part of this episode, one quick info. If you don't want to miss the best strategies for entrepreneurs like you, sign up for my newsletter with a link in the description. You will receive a summary of advice from each episode, get personal recommendations based on your startup stage and industry. And you will also receive my most useful growth and LinkedIn marketing strategies. Just follow the link in the description to sign up. Back to the next part of this interview.
The challenge here is always to convince the politicians. You mentioned before as well how we don't take into account a lot of things in our capitalist economy, like the quality of lives. So if we have less cars, if we produce less cars, some people will tell you, well, yes, there will be less jobs. What's the most efficient way, in your opinion, to start including the different quality of lives in the system, so that if people earn, you know, 1,000 euro less, they can still, you know, live? And because that's what probably most people will be, especially when we're talking about, I mean, the rich people will probably always say, oh, don't touch my money. That's one thing. But the poorest one will be like, okay, yeah, but what do I do with 1,000 euro less? I'm not even able to live right now.
That's the key challenge, I mean, as an economist. So like today, we leave capitalism because of its expensive nature, so economic growth, as a tendency to commodify certain things. So to introduce new product, to, let's say, privatize certain resources, to sell them for money after that, because that's a lot of what like for-profit entrepreneurship looks like today. People will find an opportunity to make money. And in doing this, we have locked ourselves into a situation where you need money to do everything. Pay your rent, send your kids to preschool, pay for health, and all of that. So if all of a sudden, yeah, the amount of money contracts, then you may find yourself in a situation where you cannot satisfy needs. So here we need to rethink need satisfaction outside of the for-profit motive. And what does that look like? Let me give you a very concrete example, because I think most people right now struggle with housing in big cities because it's so expensive. Why is it expensive? Why is it getting more expensive? Because of, you know, what Piketty explained, you remember this R, rates of return on private capital. People that have saved up money, they're not going to let it on their bank account, you know, they're going to invest it. One trendy investment right now is to buy property and then rent it and then resell it at a high price after that. These drives up prices of housing. And so every year you live in Paris, you see your rent increase. If you only have your wage to pay that, that locks you in a lifestyle where you cannot afford to work less. So let's say you decide to have a kid, or let's say you get very passionate about, you know, starting a new soccer team in your village, or writing a Wikipedia page about whatever passion you have, or just organizing discussions for local political election. You cannot, because you have your two jobs, you need to do this, otherwise you'll be kicked out of your apartment. So here we have two choices. Either we keep growing the economy and we hope that some of the money trickle down in your pocket so you can pay your rent. Historically, it doesn't happen. We've seen it. So already that's not going to work, but we can hope that it does. Or we can actually make sure that the price of the rent is fair. So now what does that mean? What we do is compare how different cities and countries have managed the access of certain key goods and services. If you look at the city of Vienna, which is my favorite example, because there is no for-profit housing in Vienna, which seems like so science fiction-y. Like in Vienna after the war, you know, they just decided that housing being such a basic right, like everyone needs to live somewhere. That's basic. So that's a not-for-profit good. No one can get rich investing in housing. And so most housing is social housing or just decentralized, you know, housing cooperatives that just pool some money together to, let's say, build a building and all of that. And then they have cooperative shares. But when they sell them back, when they move, they sell them back at the same price, you know, just including inflation. But there is no one getting rich. What's the result of that? Well, as the result is Vienna is one of the, you know, lower level of rent in European capitals. And it also have one of the highest quality of housing. Why? Because, you know, housing is not used to be a cash cow where you just put your money, get your money back and just invest it somewhere else. Every surplus being created in the housing sector is being reinvested into making these houses better, more qualitative, which is so important today when we need to do all these new constructions so that, you know, the heating of these houses get more efficient. So again, we see that, let's say, if we were to declare in a country like France, well, housing, here's the cap on price, not a commodity. You cannot invest. You cannot own 12 properties and just use them to make, like, to increase your income. That's not possible. Then all of a sudden, the average rent will go down tremendously, which means that, let's say, your rent before in Paris was like 1,500 euros. And now it goes down to 800 euros. Then you can afford to work less, like a few hours per week. Your quality of life is not changing because relatively you just have access to the same apartment. But because it's been made cheaper, you can afford to liberate a few of your hours, which were locked into some kind of wage work, to try to start a choir or just to train the local soccer team. The overall effect of that is that we reduce inequality. So the rich people, of course, investing in housing are not going to like it, but it's such a minority of people that at some point, you know, we cannot just make them happy because they love just being richer. But the overall effect is that rent is getting cheaper for everyone and we liberate hours to be invested in the social economy. And that's so important because it creates a lot of wealth. All of a sudden, a neighborhood where everyone is working to pay their inflated rent have the capacity to have a free soccer club, a free music school, all these kind of stuff that create a lot of community wealth.
This reminds me of the time when I arrived in Berlin 10 years ago. It was already a bit late, but I think 20 years ago, people could live in Berlin and could, this is why the city was, had so many artists at the time and was so flourishing, because people could live there with 500 euro a month. You just have to work a little bit and then they had time to do all these passionate things about art. When you said the rich, it's a minority, but the problem, it's a minority with a super, super big power and leverage on the economy at the moment. So what do you think is going to like trigger them to let, basically let down this capitalism idea there? Is it because they influence the politicians massively? Again, I'm quoting Macron here, but if we know where his ties are and where he comes from, you know how he is influenced. So how do you think it has to come from a revolution, which is actually, I think, kind of happening at right now in the streets? Does it come from the people? Does it come from does it has to be kind of a violent revolution? Is this the only way it worked in the past? I mean, you had a talk called How to Blow Up an Economy, so I'm sure you have some ideas or some opinions on that at least.
Yeah, it's a complicated Rubik's Cube. And I think here we need the full power of political scientists to better understand all these subtle lobby mechanism and the kind of culture of that very small wealthy class and the way they have to actually obstacles for them to get into this. But I don't see it as a challenge of kind of doing talks to the billionaires in Davos and having to convince them to become philanthropists to change this. History has shown that this has just never been happening, and I don't have much hope that it will happen. And we need to remember that now it's not a matter of having it happening. It's a matter of having it happening in a few years, like now. So if you're hoping that all of a sudden, after hundreds of years of exploitation, a minority of rich people are going to decide to be like, oh, after just, you know, reading a book or hearing you on a podcast, they're going to be like, well, that makes sense. I think it's a bit unfair. So I'm going to get rid of my wealth. Some people are doing it, and I've been working with, million and multi-millionaire families that are actively actually getting rid of their wealth, realizing, you know, the colonial and exploitative legacy of their family wealth. So there's a minority of people, I think, that are just realizing that this accumulation of wealth is blocking the resolution of climate issues, and so they're trying to just unlock that. For the rest, we'll have to use the tools we've always been using. I mean, you've talked of revolution, but there's also very silent daily revolution happening at the level of states. So now you're right to say that, you know, there's a huge power of lobby, and Julia Cagé on The Price of Democracy has really shown this very well. And so there's a lot of control of people with wealth to influence political decisions, but that's not all of what politics is about. There is also progressive policies being passed, and there is also massive, you know, redistribution happening already in our system, you know, very old, sophisticated systems of social security and limits of all kind. In France, for example, the Économie sociale et solidaire, social and solidary economy, is a very novel legal framework that, although, you know, for a kind of almost post-capitalist looking economy. So I think today we basically, my main point would be, we don't need to wait for that minority to do the right thing. They won't. It's like fossil fuel company. I mean, it's so funny that to say, like, we'll just wait for fossil companies to stop drilling and selling oil. I mean, we've been waiting since basically the 70s. Fossil fuel companies were the first one aware of climate change, and they're digging more than they've ever been digging. And I think, you know, if they have no pressure, democratic pressure to shut down, we'll basically, you know, climb ourselves to a 4+4+5+6 degree Mad Max world. And so what we need is to build democratic pressure with whatever democratic institutions we have. The Citizen Convention for Climate in France was a very good example of that. And to shut down the minority that is basically destroying the future of humanity. That's just a basic thing we do in many other instances, you know, like we have a justice system that if there is one single person in a place that is causing havoc and enormous damage to all the others, we'll just not teach self-defense to everyone else and be, okay, guys, here's bulletproof jackets and you need to work on your hiding skills. No, we identify the problem and we take it out. Same thing now. Let's identify the problem. The problem is narrower than we think. It lies within, you know, a few big corporations, a class of decision makers, of wealthy decision makers that just refuses to let it go because it's too lucrative, then we just need to make it legally and culturally impossible for these people to keep doing what they're doing. It's a political maze to understand how to do this, but I think right now that should be the goal. And that's why I like to talk about how to blow up an economy in reference to Andreas Malm, how to blow up a pipeline. Right now, we really need to stop thinking about the transition as a matter of like additions. Let's build nice little renewable energy companies and all these cool cooperatives, and let's not address the problem and try to replace the system. No. That's fine. Over the long term, that's going to be very important. But right now, what we need to do is to shut down whatever is emitting greenhouse gases. We need to remove certain technologies and practice out of existence. We need to degrow the economy. So we need to do this, and then we will fill that space with many alternatives that are already available. This is not, we don't need to wait science fiction for people to invent, you know, nice steady state, not-for-profit cooperatives. These have actually been existing for a very long time. And in some countries, I've talked about France and the social and solidarity economy, the legal framework is already here.
So the idea here is democratic pressure and managing to then have the politicians change the policies so that corporates cannot do that anymore. I mean, one of the questions that my audience had on LinkedIn was, how will the largest companies justify, you know, waning profits to stakeholders, most importantly, institutional investors? So in that case, in the European context, it was asking, how do pension fund and large banks would react to degrowth by companies they've invested in? In that case, I guess we are getting back to the fact that we just need to let that happen. Or
what is being certain is that today we have a choice to make. Either we continue making profits for shareholders, we know how to do this, we can continue, and we fry the only planet we have irreversibly, and that has already started. Or we accept and acknowledge the fact that for several years, yeah, these revenues are not going to increase and some of them are going to go down. That's the choice we have. The impossibility of decoupling means that it's a choice. You cannot reconcile the two. And people that have tried have been very bad at showing proof that this can be so. And I've been doing conferences at many of these companies, and I've heard their best argument. I was like really genuinely listening. I'm like, show me the proof, show me your numbers, show me your strategy, show me your model. And I was taking the time to look into this. I have not found a single proof. All they have is wishful scenarios of like, we hope this happens. And 80% of that is not even real scenarios. They are kind of marketing depictions of desired futures that legitimate the business as usual. So you could call this some kind of greenwashing. So yeah, today we need to acknowledge the fact that during a period of transition, there's not going to be a win-win-win. That's the thing. Sustainable development as a concept since the late 80s was built on that concept of win-win-win. We do things and everyone like works. Like energy gets cheaper for households. You get profit opportunities for new companies. The emissions go down and the government's revenue goes up and health costs for the governments go down. And it's all happy and nice. I think today we've reached a point where we have to acknowledge the fact that, yeah, we're going to do some massive modifications and some people are going to get relatively worse off than they were before. And that's where the fairness of that transition is so important. Whatever you touch, if you touch the mobility sector, if you touch education, if you touch public finances, you need to make sure that the people that get worse off are not the people that are already at the bottom today, because that's unsustainable. And that's just unsustainable in the sense of it defeats the purpose of an economy, which is to satisfy its need. So basically, you want to make sure that the people that are better off today will be worse off in the sense of like, those people are the ones that can shoulder that transition best. They're in a space of high comfort, high security. They can see their income go down. That's not a problem. They're not going to be thrown in abject poverty. The same way that if you, if you're earning, let's say you're in the top 1% of income earners in France, so you're above like 6,500 euros after tax per month. Let's say that get cuts in two. Like, you're not going to go hungry, or you're not going to be in the streets. if you're working minimum wage and your income is being cut in half, you fall into poverty. So I think the balance here in the transition is we need macroeconomically, so that can be done in the spirit of social justice, to make sure that the people today that have the biggest ability to pay and also the biggest historical responsibility in greenhouse gases. We don't talk about this very often, but you know, there's a high correlation between wealth and emissions. So it's pretty normal, I would say, that rich countries and the globally rich in general, wherever they live, like bear the brunt of the transition because they're the one that have really enjoyed a high carbon lifestyle. So I think there are many ways of justifying why the split of the effort is going to be different in that transition. And we should not pay. I mean, I think I don't find it convincing, you know, the rich people that say like, we are all in the same boat and we all need to reduce part of that. It's like you're living in a corridor and you share a corridor with a lot of different students and, you know, and you're running out of food because there's two people in the corridor that have been eating like 80% of the food. And they're like, okay, guys, we all need to reduce our food intake by 50%. And like, you would look at them and be like, dude, there's a bit of a problem in your calculus. Like, just stop eating, overeating all the food, and then we can all have enough. It's basic childlike logic that basically people are trying to rebuke using highly sophisticated economic concept that I don't find very convincing as an economist because I can see through them. So I think in the end, we're back to a very simple philosophical problem is we are going to have to use less natural resources. And so we will have to share them more equitably. That's it. You have five kids. There were just 10 toys. Now there's just, you know, four toys. If you want every kid to be able to play, you have to share the toys. I mean, we've all learned that in elementary schools. That basic ethical rule will now have to apply for climate space, for, you know, water availability, for access to nature, and for also access to all the kind of social infrastructure necessary to satisfy needs.
If this podcast helps you, please do me a huge favor and click on the follow button on your podcast platform. It helps to grow this podcast faster and to convince the most impactful entrepreneurs of the world to join me in these interviews so that you and other entrepreneurs can learn from them.
You are tackling a very important thing here. It's like the efforts have to be different on the different countries. So my follow-up question here is like two questions actually. From the myth, I heard a lot from people arguing about degrowth that I saw in your presentation. Degrowth is not recession on one side. And people think they're using degrowth, it'll be okay, degrowing. But in some of the charts you saw in some of your conferences, you explain how the growth is going to degrowth. And then we find stability in the economy when it keeps on going up and down and up and down with some stability. Can you explain a bit more here what you mean by the difference between degrowth and recession, and especially what's for the poorest country? Do they need to degrow in that system that you're referring to or that you're wishing we go to?
Yeah. So people are going to hate me because I go back to the analogy of the diet all the time. But here, degrowth, if we compare it to a diet, and it's very similar in logic, it's going to be temporary. So you're not going to degrow forever. The goal is to degrow to what we call a steady state. Some people refer to this as post-growth. So you're a country in ecological overshoot. You need to get back within planetary boundaries. So for a certain period of time, you're going to reduce production and consumption to the point where you actually get to an economic scale that can be made biophysically sustainable. Then there's no point continuing your diet. Then you enter the post-growth mentality. Of course, you don't want to fall back within exponential growth patterns because otherwise you're going to cross planetary boundaries again. That is laws of physics, you know, infinite economic growth within finite planet historically doesn't go very well. Something at the end always have to give. And so your economy is going to oscillate. And the idea of a dynamic steady state is, I think, quite inspiring to rethink the very purpose of an economy. Anthropologically, an economy is the social organization of needs satisfaction. I dare everyone listening to us to think about all your needs. You'll think about, you know, the stuff you need to eat, the medicine and the doctors you need to see when you're sick, the house you need to have. I dare you to find me one need that is just growing exponentially
You know, even sickness, you would fall sick, then you need to have access to medicine and a doctor to fall back within health. Equilibrium is restored. You go hungry, you need to find a finite amount of food, healthy access to food. You don't need an exponentially growing amount of food, like 10% every year. Same thing, let's say you're poor in terms of mobility and you cannot go where you want to go. Then you get yourself a bike or, you know, access to a tram or whatever, and then you can go from A to B. You don't need a 3% yearly rate in the production of bikes infinitely. So if we admit that somehow the economy has a purpose of need satisfaction, we understand that in times where unsatisfied needs are many, let's say you have a pandemic hitting and all of a sudden there's a lot of unsatisfied health needs, of course you need to increase productive capacity. Maybe that means training more doctors. Maybe that means more respirators or whatever tools, more masks. You activate that part of the economy, which is going to grow until you can satisfy all needs. Then the pandemic go away and there is no point being like, yeah, let's keep producing even more respirators and let's all invest into mask companies. No, no, no. Just, okay, now we can stabilize. Let's decrease actually the amount of stuff we produce. So you see this kind of dynamic equilibrium, and that's so important. Why? Because if you have a finite quantity of available resources, once you finish that growth of the sector, you need to liberate some resources for another sector that might need them either today or tomorrow. You cannot squander resources just at one single point in the present. So that's how I always associate temporary planned degrowth towards a dynamic steady state. And then that also allows us with this framework to orchestrate different situation for the global north and the global south. So global north, all high income countries, they are overshooting planetary boundaries. So they're biophysically obese, but they have also a scale where they can reduce, eradicate poverty without growing their economy. So that's a very comfortable position for degrowth. And so for them, it's a contraction to a steady state. Global south is the opposite. Some of them don't have enough productive capacity to meet all the needs of their population. If you just don't have roads, there's no doctors, there's no school, it's just, you know, if you want to increase your level of education and life expectancy, you will have to build hospitals. You will have to build, you know, train doctors and all of that. There is no way around it. It's no magic. So these countries, they will need to grow their productive capacity so they can reach that dynamic steady state where all needs are satisfied at a sustainable scale. And that's where a very important point about the sharing of scarce natural resources happen. Remember I said we were in global overshoot of several planetary boundaries. This means that globally, for example, we need to see greenhouse gases emissions go down, which means that the growth of emissions in the global south needs to be more than compensated by the degrowth of emissions in high-income countries. So now we realize why stabilization of emissions in the global north, or just, you know, these kind of bullshit minus 1% per year decrease, is just not enough, because we need to liberate massive amounts of resources so that the global south can have a real shot at eradicating poverty. That is why degrowth in the global north is also a justice issue. It's not only for the resilience of the country like France and Belgium and all of that, it's also something that if we don't do, it means we accept the fact that people on the globe, a large part of humanity will never have access to, enough natural resources to satisfy the needs of their population, which ethically is very difficult to defend.
Thank you for presiding that. I mean, that's way clearer for me now. Let's go to the last part that I wanted to tackle with you today, which is degrowth, post-growth for, you know, entrepreneurs changing the world for the better, people who are listening to this podcast usually. So from what I get, I'm trying to make my own assumptions here. From what I get here is we need to get out of oil to fight against climate change. If I take your idea here, green tech companies that are helping to solve this the oil issues with this world, the pollution with that, they should be allowed, especially when we talk about companies starting, they should be allowed to grow. And hypergrowth for these companies seems to be totally fine, but they have to accept that in a near future, they cannot have exponential growth the whole time. They will have to reach a dynamic, steady state. So my two questions are, am I making a correct assumptions here in my theory? And the second is, how do we adapt business models for that? Because usually these companies, a lot of them, especially we know in these podcasts, I interview a lot of software and hardware like founders, and there is something, you can bootstrap software. You can, you know, like make it at your own pace without relying on investors. But technologies that need to really change, that can massively improve the world for like against pollution, like green tech, usually hardware requires a lot of investment. And usually this investment comes from investors who expect return on investment like that. So you already told me that, you know, investors need to change their mind. Of course, that's one thing. But do we need to adapt the business models of companies?
Yeah. So first, like the explanation you give, I think is valid. So if you're an entrepreneur working in these kind of solutions that are aiming to replace, for example, oil, coal, and gas, you need to have a replacement mindset. So your goal is to replace, to phase out, you know, these technologies. I think it started in the UK or in Sweden, I don't remember where, that deflate SUV tires. It's an innovative venture. Those people, they're like, they don't sell a service, but they function exactly as you would expect a company to function. You know, they have people somehow participating, mobilizing time and effort, organizing in a certain way, in a structure to deliver a specific service. And so I find it strange that we call that activism and not entrepreneurship, whereas it's exactly the same thing. So now I want people to broaden their view on entrepreneurship and be like, you know what, when I identify my mission, some mission is going to be non-lucrative, and there's going to be today a lot of shutdown missions, and we need the most creative minds to focus on these problems. We need as much innovation as we can to find ways for SUVs to disappear out of existence. I'm not saying, you know, the solution that these people found to deflate them is best. Truth is, we have more and more SUVs, cars are getting larger, and that's a problem. And no one so far has found a way of reverting this. If you're listening to this and you're, you know, innovative entrepreneurs with a lot of kick-ass idea, like go. And that mission is more likely to remove greenhouse gases fast than, you know, any problem-solving tech solution you may find on like carbon removal or alternative energy or even electric cars. So that's the first introducing this category of what we call exnovation. So taking a technology or practice out of use in contrast to innovation. Then to your second part of the question, it's true that if you launch yourself into any kind of ventures and you say, okay, well, that's going to be a for-profit legal framework. And you know what? I'm even going to finance myself with private investors demanding high rates of return. Then you're locking yourself into what we call a growth imperative. And at some point, yeah, your investors are going to knock at the door and be like, what have you been doing? And you're like, I've been deflating SUV tires. And they're like, where's my money? And you're going to be, oh, well, I've created a lot of saved greenhouse emissions, but not really money because it's not valued by the system. And you're going to go bankrupt. So you might want to use, like, there's not a lot of not-for-profit business models. So these models, like the French SEEC, for example, which is one form of cooperative, where when you create it, you have a social or ecological mission. And all it's legally impossible for the profits you make in achieving that mission to be distributed to private individuals. So that also evacuate an incentive of everyone within the company or in the investors to use that mission as an excuse to get rich. So it also means that, you know, whatever money you make, and you can sometimes make a profit if you're in a fast expanding sectors, will be reinvested in your mission until your mission is solved. And when your mission is solved, you also need to have some flexibility. And that's where the cooperatives get interesting. That's where the idea of economic democracy is interesting, because within a cooperative where you have what we call a multi-stakeholder board of governance, it's not shareholders and managers. It's multi-stakeholders, so for example, representative of your customers, of your suppliers, of the municipality, of your engineers, of environmentalists working on the kind of resources you use. You all sit down and you assess the social and ecological mission. Maybe you realize, you know what, guys? That mission we had 2 years ago, it's solved. We look at social and ecological indicator, we solved it. What do we do now? And you can have what we call these kind of redirection écologique, ecological redirection, repurposing of a company. And this agility is so important in a well-being economy because, again, the company could be like, well, let's keep making more money out of that mission, first mission we had. But since you're a not-for-profit company, there's no point because no one can appropriate this money. So rather you'd be like, okay, what mission should we tackle now? So I like this kind of agility. I think that fits also with the kind of entrepreneur spirit of people constantly seeking to improve, to solve problems that no one has found solution for. So for me, that's how I can argue that actually a post-growth, post-capitalist, this kind of not-for-profit, cooperative-based economy will be much more faster and agile in satisfying needs because it won't get locked into growth imperative. Last point on the financing system of the economy. Today, we have a weird way, like as a macroeconomist, I still find it pretty strange when you look at the entire economy, which means it's a bit like a beauty contest. So let's say every entrepreneur has to go on stage and pitch their idea to rich people that have accumulated money. If you convince them, they'll give you money. If you don't, they won't. Over time, we realize that the project that gets selected, it's not, solving very niche diseases in the global south and working on household violence or, you know, ecological issues. No, that doesn't get funded. No, that's just tech, AI, extractive industries, marketing, all the stuff that in terms of need satisfaction is not just very high purpose. But then I'm thinking, just like that's an open question. I'm like, is it really efficient and effective for us in an economy to rely on the subjective judgment of a handful of rich people to decide what we should invest in? So what we need to rethink today is basically how we decide collectively to finance stuff. I mean, investing is a core anthropological concept. It means mobilizing available resources today to develop something that will be able in the future to satisfy needs. So let me give you an interesting investment. Like today, we should mobilize available resources, energy, some tools and workers and organizing power to destroy concrete in cities, to take it out so that we can plant trees instead. What will we get out of this? Why are we not doing it? Because there is no money in it. The trees, they're not in 10 years going to just ask you for your IBAN and just send you the money with return and be like, thank you so much for just making me grow. No, what you're going to create is cooler cities, cities with shadows, city with biodiversity, cities that can filtrate water better, that are more resilient to flood, that can absorb carbon, all of that. Also, all the kind of cultural and aesthetic aspect of living in green cities and the good it makes, especially when you grow up and all of that. So that's a true investment that reaps a lot of benefits. We're not doing it today because we're asking a minority of investors what they want, and what they want is to get richer because that's what they get used to. In doing that, we're actually getting faster and faster towards an ecological cliff. So I think today we need to have a very difficult discussions about phenomenon of investment and accept the fact that there should be different kinds of investment. The one for the ecological transition cannot be reduced to a kind of positive return, short-term investment. It doesn't fit these kind of profile. It needs to be organized with an organization with a longer span, even a longer span than the state itself. I like, you know, the central bank, we all know how the central bank works. And the central bank is kind of have a longer span than the state. It's just focusing on one thing, you know, preserving monetary stability. Imagine having the equivalent of a central bank, but for nature, a kind of like nature bank. It will be just above government. And it's just like the central bank focuses on an inflation target. Your nature bank will focus on a certain kinds of ecological stability, which involves in rich countries a downscaling of ecological footprint. And so then we make sure we have an institution that can actually conduct all of this investment into replanting trees, depolluting the soil, building preservation, sanctuarizing resources, doing all these kind of stuff that our normal economy and our normal government, because they're too short-term organization, cannot do. And of course, politically, we need to make sure that this nature bank is able to appropriate parts of create like available resources to do these kind of investments, just like, you know, we have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and all of these that finance themselves out of, you know, countries' economic activity. So I think it's not beyond the realm of our imagination to imagine that we just need to apply the kind of same logic of preserving the common good by creating some kind of meta organization. But we need to do it one that will be the protector of the habitability of the earth
and our planet. I think marketing can be used in way better ways that this is used at the moment for profit and for lots of companies and for lobbying. And I see a shift as well in the term of like new investors. You can see Team for the Planet in France. They have now hundreds of thousands of investors who are expecting no ROI. They are using marketing very well, actually, to grow that. And I think awareness is key for that. What is the example of multi-stakeholders, non-profit company, like the ideal company that you we want to have in the future? Because I think it's very important. If we show example, then it's easier to lead towards that direction. Do you have one company in mind that is actually representing that ideal company for you now? Association or service or?
I recently read, there are many of them. None of them that I think people will know, because it won't be a surprise to know that global corporations are very known brands, don't function like this. But small examples, one I've read recently was this housing cooperative in Toulouse, and Toulouse in the south of France. And how did they work? Is they realized that, well, housing is unaffordable. We also don't want to get locked into this growth imperative. So you know what? We're going to become housing entrepreneur. So as a group of whatever, 30, 40 people, they pool themselves like the savings they had to buy houses. They also applied to various funding and crowdfunding of some kinds. And it's like, we're going to build our own housing cooperative. So they had their building built, just like a normal housing company would do. And then once this is out, they reimbursed a loan that they had here and there. And then once they've done this, they've maintained somehow access to that cooperative at stable price. So you move out, you resell your share to new people moving it at the very same price. It is completely emancipated from market prices, which protect you. And it does the very same thing. I mean, every housing company could follow the same model. The only difference would be so that will be much more affordable housing for everyone. Much more agile adaptation. When you look at the actual building they've built, it's wonderful. They have a shared garden. They have shared guest rooms. They have all the shared tool libraries, bike room, all these kind of tools that I think many people will find enjoyable, because they allow you to satisfy needs that we cannot currently satisfy when you're living in your 22 square meters crammed in Paris and you have to share bathroom on the floor and you don't have access to a single garden. So here we realize that quality of life goes up. You get protected. If there is an economic crisis, you get protected because you've built this kind of economically secured need satisfaction, where there's no landlord that's going to be, I've just decided your rent is going to go double because, that's how it goes, which any landlord can basically do in these big cities when you have fast changing prices. They're protected against this. So now I'm thinking the same logic of not-for-profit cooperative venture, which is basically a not-for-profit legal status added to a democratic stakeholder management, where the people using the resource make the decision about the resource. It's not, the owners of the means of production that is just deciding we do whatever is good to maximize exchange value, so financial wealth. It's just the user themselves, as commoners, we call them, in the theory of commons, that is go together and decide how to best maximize the well-being of that economic infrastructure we are governing together.
What's your view on how many years we have left before to react, basically? Because I was drawn into that the past couple of weeks, and it's kind of scary when we're talking about +3, +4 degrees from the IPCC report at the end of the century. I read that actually some of the new models right now are coming up with 10 to 15 years before that happens, because you are, an ecological economist. I guess you are aware more than I am of the latest report on that. How long do we have? How quickly do we need to react?
As an ecological economist, I spend a lot of time reading reports of ecological health. And the true answer to that is that we have until the 1970s. So that's when we should have acted to maintain, to avoid ecological overshoot 50 years ago. That's, you know, when like bossy people in a company, they ask you for a report and you ask like, for when do I need to do this? And they're like, yesterday. Well, that's precisely, that applies to the ecological transition. When is the deadline? In the 1970s. So you're like, oh, fuck. So we're extremely late. There's been some irreversible damage that can already be felt. Not in all rich countries, even so now we see some extreme events happening. I mean, the heat waves in France, the forest fires in Canada, you know, these kind of events, they are the consequences of past, you know, emissions of greenhouse gases that led to global warming. That's now a scientific fact that has been well studied and explained by scientists cited in the IPCC report. So what the question of like how many years we have, I think should not even be asked. Like, we don't have any years, and the life of people, unfortunately, in the global south. So that's the problem with the climate change. When you look at historical responsibility, most of it comes from the global north. They're together responsible for 92% of historical emissions. But when you look at the impact in terms of human death and degradation of quality of life, it's mostly for the poorest people of the global south. So we don't feel it. I mean, I'm not a Somalian fisherman that saw, you know, fisheries collapsed decades ago and had to become a pirate because my historical livelihood was just threatened and I had no economic agility to kind of shift to another sector. Like, these people, we're going to tell them like, okay, how long we have to do things? Like, no, there's like, we should have avoided the collapse of the fishery. So I think even asking this question could easily be turned into a what we call a discourse of delay. Be like, okay, we have 3 years. Fine, guys. We're not going to act too fast now. We don't want to be the front runners. We're going to wait for the government to introduce this. Just, you know, have stricter regulation. We're going to wait for the competitors and the suppliers to push us to do it. And then no. This is, we should go into crisis war economy mode right now. Whatever you can do as fast as you can do it, in the sense of like, be in an entrepreneurial mode of like, whatever you're trying to create, you're creating it in a house that is actually on fire. So whatever you create, if you don't extinguish the fire, that will have just no value whatsoever, except if you're working on the production of extinguishers and social ways of applying it to the actual fire. So that's what I say to that, to the narrative. And you're completely right about the exponentiality of the risk of the climate risk, and that the more we delay this means two things. It means the more we overshoot planetary boundaries, means the more we take the chance of the elevator, you know, breaking down with tragic loss of life, human and non-human, as we see in the forest fire, for example. And the more difficult the transition will be, in the same way that, you know, the more you eat, you're like, okay, how long do I have to lose weight? Like, your doctor is going to be like, well, since you're like four times the healthy weight you should be, and you're risking of, you know, dying of some kind of heart disease, like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you like, yeah, you have a safe 10 years, like as soon as you can will be the best for yourself. And also the more you continue gaining weight means the more you will have to lose in the future. Now that becomes a problem. Why? Because as we've discussed, politically, it's difficult to reorganize your economy. It takes some time. It takes some time of discussing, of convincing people. And so the more we wait, the more we will have to make this transition in a hurry, because we're doing it in the context of an ecological collapse. So my tagline is either, you know, planned democratic degrowth today or chaotic collapse tomorrow. Whatever we want of this transition, you know, it's a bit like you can decide between doing a diet today in a harmonious manner, and you lose your 20 kilos in a way that is selective, efficient, temporary, and you bring back in health, or you wait, and you know, you're confronted with instant death, and then you do an amputation. You cut yourself a leg, and you lose the 20 kilos you were supposed to lose with a diet. When you compare the two in terms of well-being, and we can do these scenarios, one is clearly better than the other. And I think any sane individual would say, I would rather do the diet now than to have to chop off one of my leg in a couple of years. So we're there.
I can extend your metaphors here if you want for the future, because I think if you cut your leg at that point, you will use your 20 kilos, but you will still look like shit on the rest of your body. Or if you take the elevator, I think the longer we wait, the higher we're going up at the moment.
Oh, that's brilliant.
The higher you're gonna fall down when the rope is gonna break.
I'm gonna reuse that if you allow me.
There is no IP on anything. I'm just really thankful for all your metaphors, because I'm not really good at finding metaphors, and you find so many of them. So thank you very much for all of that. I mean, I have one last questions, two last questions. One I usually ask, and one which is here is, how do you find yourself? How do you find the balance between optimism, action, you know, hope, urgency, and fear? Do you have any advice here? I understand you. We have to act. But reading all these things personally, I felt really bad for a couple of days. What is the advice you have for our audience to keep on fighting, to keep on having the energy to do it, and to have this urgency, but to also to not be depressed by it?
You know, I think when you're in a situation of danger, let's say you wake up in your house is on fire, you get all these kind of unconscious senses that are kicking in. Somehow you'll be faster, you'll be smarter, you'll just do all the right thing. Even collectively, we'll just organize in a way that is just very fast to solve that problem. So today we need to tap into that. Getting aware of the situation is a huge emotional drain, because the situation is alarming does not cover. It's catastrophic. It's nightmarish. It's just so tragic. It will just, you know, keep you awake at night. And this is why we see, you know, the young generation and the old generation, Jack, doing like very brave acts of activism, laying down. Like I've seen my colleague Julia Steinberger, you know, an older scientist, very renowned scientist, laying down on a road, almost being run down by a truck. Because, you know, those scientists, they don't know what to do anymore. So I think we need to first respect this outburst of energy. We're like, wow, these people, if you're willing to get smashed by a car, by blocking a highway, you must have discovered something that is worth hearing. And then we need to channel this kind of sense of urgency into a collective spider sense, you know, this kind of sixth sense. I was like, oh, something's happening, and then use this hyper consciousness to refocus all of our effort and energy. Being like, I receive messages every day from people that be like, oh, I've read your book, I've heard about this, and I realize, you know, I can no longer work for my company because, you know what, like, I cannot be part of that system. So now, right now, I'm going to use my skills, I'm going to use my time, I'm going to use my network, I'm going to use my infrastructure to just try to solve these problems. And I think if we're a mass of people doing that, there'll be more people trying to solve the problem than people trying to perpetuate the problem. And that I think we'll reach that system shift. And the only way of building that collective sense is to connect together. Alone, we will all fall into some kind of like echo depression, because it's too heavy to bear. For us, like as communities of growth skeptics, of ecological economists, of sustainability scientists, I'm in connection and talk with hydrologists and climatologists and climate psychologists like every day to talk about these stuff. And we get a feeling of we're trying to solve something, in the same way that probably when you're an entrepreneur and you join one of those big fancy Silicon Valley company and you feel the buzzing of ideas, we get the same within that environmental community. It's just the very same collective spirit of innovation that keeps us alive. So this is not something we will solve individually, but we just need, again, to make sure that in terms of scale, we are more people focusing in, you know, phasing out that problem than people working in making it bigger.
Join activism, join the group. Can you tell me one thing about you that I wouldn't be able to find out online?
Oh, wow. Many, many things, I guess. I can do a backflip on a mountain bike.
You can do a backflip on a mountain bike?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite pastimes. It's called slopestyle mountain biking, and you build jumps, and you go on a mountain bike with a helmet and everything, and at a high speed, and you do some tricks, 360s, front flips, backflips, Superman. It's very fun. That's how I get my head out of academic matters and the impending doom of life on Earth.
I can't wait to see a video of that online from you.
That'll be the next step, recording a podcast while I'm riding my bike.
Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting new podcast idea or video ideas, instead of having these guys who are taking people, you know, like all the, like what's this taxi stuff where they take people in the car. We should do it on a bike, and we should do the interview on a bike. I give you an idea now, and I, you give me an idea of how I'm going to run this.
Extremely risky, but let's try it.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Timothée. One thing, you know, for the audience here, you released a book called Ralentir ou Périr, Slow Down or Die. Can you tell us where they can find it? When is it going to be available in English? Because I read it in French because I have the chance to speak French. Where can people find you? When can they learn more about your work or your theories?
So I've got a website, timothéeparic.com, where I try to gather all the lectures, podcasts, and stuff that I've done. The book, so Ralentir ou Périr, l'économie de la décroissance, which I really insist must be translated as Slow Down or Perish, the economics of degrowth, and not Slow Down or Die, because death is unavoidable. But perish, which is to die in an accident, can completely be prevented. And so this, the Spanish translation comes out next month. There will be a German, a Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean translation coming out next year. And the English translation, still under negotiation, I hope will also come out in 2024. So you'll be able to read about it. And in any case, I've started to write a second book, which will come out in both English and French at the same time.
Amazing. Thank you very much for your time today, Timothée. And I wish you a beautiful day and keep on doing the amazing work you're doing in raising awareness about degrowth and keep on working on like these new ways and influencing us on also showing us the way forward.
Well, thank you for the lovely talk.
Hey, if today's episode was useful, share it with your entrepreneurs' friends so that we can all have a bigger impact on this planet. And give it a 5-star on Apple Podcasts. That will make my day. Thanks so much in advance. Have a nice day.